what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball. All basketball, all the time, although we do other sports, too. So just all ball. Sports have balls. I hope maybe you have balls, although not all of you have balls. I mean, we would like women to listen to it as well. Chad Wilkerson is my guest upcoming. He led the state in scoring in the state of Texas twice as a high school player. He went to ORU his last 2 years. He had outstanding years. We played together in the USBL on one of these tour teams as well. We'll talk about a potential double bird incident at Texas Tech that I may or may not be guilty of. Plus, he played overseas, and he's got a great charity that we'll get into. Also, some of his thoughts and my thoughts on college basketball and what they should do to spice it up. Let me give you a couple thoughts NBA-wise. Not surprised the Nets are really good because both Kyrie and KD are awesome. And this is kind of a fuck you tour for Kevin Durant. That's really what it is. Right? Kevin Durant, for his career, has probably felt like, look, I was the best player in the league, or at least he thought he was the best player in the league. He was in Oklahoma City, led the league in scoring several times over. So then, like, oh, I can't win a championship? Fine. Now I'll go to the Warriors. They need me. And he not only won two championships, could have won a third, but, you know, beat out LeBron James for the MVP and, frankly, outplayed LeBron James. And we can go into the, if you think it's not fair, or they had too many players. And the reality is that at the time they played, Kevin Love was a superstar, Kyrie Irving was a superstar, and LeBron James was a superstar. I don't know why that's not equal to what the Warriors had. What? Because the Warriors had they had a better team? Well, Draymond Green and Tristan Thompson, well, Draymond I like better offensively, but they're both star role players. So, look, my thing is, I thought KD was better than LeBron in the finals both those 2 years. Then they would have won a third NBA championship, not from tearing his Achilles tendon. Sits all of last year and comes back, and turns out he's still awesome. So not surprising. But the Spencer Dinwiddie injury, and maybe Spencer didn't fit with them. Maybe he should have been an off-the-bench guy, whatever. But you're gonna need some depth this year. They're going to need to find a way to get another dude. I like Spencer a lot, and I think the thing that Spencer could provide them with Caris LeVert is if Kyrie went crazy and doesn't want to follow the defense assignments and whatever, then all of a sudden, can you sit him? And it's harder to sit him, or harder to sit Kyrie, now that you'll have such a drop-off without Spencer Dinwiddie there. But not a surprise, the Nets should be the best team in the East. I still like Milwaukee, good team. Obviously, when they shoot as well as they've shot a couple nights this year, they'll be great. But they're still widely dependent upon Giannis Antetokounmpo. And you have to remember that one of the things the Nets have been able to do, they have two shot blockers that I believe can guard Giannis, and they have KD who can guard Giannis with his size and his length and his name, so he won't get called for the fouls. I think the Nets, a lot's going to depend upon health. I think the Nets, I would rank them one ahead of the Bucks, who wins and loss wise are just okay. It's hard to take these games seriously so far. In the East, Sixers still a work in progress. Not sure if they're going to go after Harden and not go after Harden. The Daryl Morey tweet was weird, super weird. But I do like the Nets. I really like the Clippers. And it's interesting that so many people are so off the Clippers and like, wow, their chemistry was bad and they fell apart in the bubble. They did. Do you know who else's chemistry was bad and they fell apart late and then they reassembled the team in year two and won a championship? That would be the LA Lakers, who also, by the way, fired their coach after their first year. I think the Clippers, they maybe shouldn't be the favorites, but the co-favorites or the 1Bs to the Lakers, those two dudes can seriously play. I like the Ibaka addition, and I think that they've made additions of guys that don't need the basketball, still haven't totally solved the point guard thing, but I like the Clippers. And the West is relatively tough, but I don't think Denver... You know, now that you're depending more on Michael Porter Jr., who he can be a 25 a night guy, but now they can't really stop anybody. They just can't. I don't love their ability to win a championship, but they're going to be really competitive. Same thing with Utah. Donovan Mitchell is awesome. It's a really good team. And the Warriors are the team that I hate what they've done, because it means that Steph has to dominate the ball more, and that's not where he's at his best. The Lakers, the Clippers, I think the Nets... and the Bucks, and we'll see if somebody wants to trade for James Harden. That's generally the early look on the NBA. And then they, you know, I know that most of these guys don't think they should be playing yet. Some haven't played in so long. Some just finished playing like 2 weeks ago. But the disparity in some of these games and the margin of victory is like hard to watch, even if you love the actual talent in the association. All right, quickly on college basketball. Look, I've been formulating this hypothesis over why Kentucky sucks so far. Carolina's still down. Duke's you know, not great. UCLA, Kansas, obviously, their talent's a little bit off, but it's Bill Self, and they're still they have enough veterans. I think they'll still be very competitive. They may well win the Big 12 because he's that good, and their culture is that good. But it started with Villanova. It's going to continue here a little bit with Virginia, although they lost some guys to the draft. DeAndre Hunter especially went early, went really, really early. Kyle Guy went early as well. But I think you're going to see it with Gonzaga, even though they're going to lose a one and done in Jalen Suggs. And the depth of the Big Ten is the easiest indicator for the change in college basketball. This is a hypothesis that I think will play out and become a theory over time. Right? Theory is a hypothesis that's been proven correct, at least on some level. Is that I think we're in the middle of a sea change in college hoop. We are. Now, we've gone through the transfer thing, and that does matter, right? Eric Pascal, of course, transferred to Villanova. How did that change them forever? They've had players redshirt as well. I mean, look, if they don't have Jalen Brunson, I don't know if the thing all works out. That doesn't all kind of come together and win those two national championships, but they did. But the idea is it was always been hard to win with 18, 19. And look, some of these kids are old holdbacks, prep school. Some of them are 20 when they get to school. It's always been difficult to compete at the very top of college basketball once you get deep in the NCAA tournament when you have kids and they have men. But if you have an Anthony Davis as a freshman, but here's what's interesting. Let's look at Cal's one championship. It's Anthony Davis and that group of Kentucky Wildcats. What's fascinating about it is, I pointed out, Syracuse and Carolina were the two best other teams. Carolina that year had lost to them by 2 points in Rupp Arena. Kendall Marshall got hurt, broke, I think, his wrist against Creighton, and they lost in the Elite Eight to Kansas. Syracuse, they lost their center, Fab Mello, rest in peace, to academic suspension right before that tournament. They never faced either of those teams. So, yeah, they won, but were they really the best team? The reason I point that out is because now you're going to take the top five kids or some five out of the top 10 kids. I'm probably going to go to this G League select team. You add in Memphis is now one of those recruiting juggernauts and what Penny has been able to do. And Kentucky is no longer able to get the five best kids or five of the 10 best kids because five of them are gone. That doesn't mean they can't get five of the next 20, 25 kids, but those guys are such a substantial drop off from the top five. You're not going to have an Anthony Davis anymore. And those guys, the likelihood that they go to college or that they go to Kentucky and there's enough supporting talent. And look, Cal has missed on some of these transfers where these kids look really good at a lower level. You transfer up to the level of Kentucky and it's a different brand of basketball. I point that out because I believe that over the next 5 years, unless the rules change, and even then, it's a bit of a slow changing ship. I think like the Big Ten those are the perfect schools to be positioned to win long term because they're recruiting good, solid players that may end up being NBA players, a Luka Garza, whatever, but not immediate impact college guys. And because of that, they stay longer. They are older. And now, I mean, look at Wisconsin. They're starting. Demetri Trice is 24 years old. You know, you're starting two 24-year-olds. They're going to, of course, they're going to beat teams with 18, 19-year-old kids. Of course they are. I think the Big Ten has positioned themselves because they're going to bring so many kids back on a yearly basis to be the conference of the next at least half decade, if not entire decade. That's a belief I have because everybody else is not every other school. You know, Notre Dame could be there too. I think Virginia more so than Carolina and Duke because Carolina and Duke, they're such fashionable glamour schools and they recruit to kind of the NBA model. It's harder to keep them in school. And when you have younger players, it's really hard to compete against the old men. And the draft is going to get younger and younger and younger and younger. We're on a cycle where I don't see it ending anytime soon. I want to welcome in a friend of mine. His name's Chad Wilkerson. Played at ORU. He's a really good player, a really good dude. He's got an awesome charity. I want you to hear about things that they do. But let's catch up with the former Oral Roberts star. All right, let's welcome him in. He works for Impacts Hoops, and he's also joining us on the 15th anniversary of his wedding. Right, like that, that's always fascinating to me on what guys do on their anniversary day. So he got married on New Year's, which I think we got to get to. He's a dad. He's a coach. He's a former Hooper himself. He's Chad Wilkerson, and he joins us in the All Ball podcast. Chad, how are you?
I'm doing great, Doug. I'm so humbled and grateful to be on your podcast. I'm looking forward to this conversation and sharing a few things.
Okay, so your basketball background started where? When you started hoop, what's your first memories of hoop?
My dad was a high school coach in Grand Prairie, Texas. I grew up in the gym. I remember just kind of hanging out with him, and especially when I got into those 10, 11, 12-year-old age, just being around his JV teams and his varsity teams, kind of be not necessarily a ball boy, but kind of a ball boy. I'd get out there at halftime and shoot shots, waiting for my turn to compete and play the great game of basketball.
That's funny, the halftime shots thing. Okay, so this is a true story. Maybe I need to throw my brother on to this. So my brother was a star at El Medina High School in the city of Orange. That's when I was supposed to go to. And I was the ball boy, and I used to go during halftime, I'd go, and everyone knows me now as a guy who couldn't shoot in college, but I was a great shooter as a kid, and people would count in the stands how many threes that I would make,
yep.
Right? And I'm sure they did the same thing, right? You're a little guy out there just spinning it and shooting jump shots. So did you play for your dad in high school?
I did. I played for my dad in high school, my junior and senior year at a small Christian school in Grand Prairie, Texas. The starting lineup was actually myself. My little brother was a 6'6 sophomore, my cousin, my best friend from down the road, and the one kid we recruited from South Grand Prairie High School who wasn't starting there but could start for us. It was a incredible season of life where we just lived and breathed hooping. I mean, it was normal for us to go to the high school gym, at 10 o'clock at night and stay till midnight, just playing the game.
That's awesome. That's like my dream. Like I never thought about being a high school coach, and I'm coaching my son in AAU, and he's like, "Dad, you should coach me in high school." I'm like, "Well, my thing was I wouldn't necessarily have his friends or a cousin. Well, maybe his cousin. He's my nephew could hoop a little bit. I got to go recruit some dudes. Got to go get some dudes. Okay, so why Oral Roberts?
My mom and dad went to Oral Roberts University. My dad is from Southern Cal. My grandfather had a church in Ontario, California. My dad went to Chaffee High School in Ontario, and they heard about this university in Oklahoma. My dad jumped on a train and went there and actually played baseball and basketball at ORU for just a couple years there. And so growing up, I'd heard about Oral Roberts University, and I'd wanted to go there because it was a university that I felt like I could play at, but also study the things that were important to me. And I just happened to be there at the same time of this young coach, a guy who was a pretty decent coach named Bill Self. It just happened to be there.
Bill had, and Bill loves to tell the story. He's like, I'll never forget when he got the Kansas job, right? And it was, he got the Kansas job. He's like, you guys know I went 6-21 my first year, right? when they're recruiting you, they're 10-17. Like, what was the recruiting process like?
It was interesting. They did a home visit. They didn't do their homework per se because they were like, well, you got to go to chapel, you got to wear a tie. But my mom and dad wanted me to go to chapel. They wanted me to wear a tie. They had grown up, attending the university and believing what it stood for. And, but I was so gung ho. I was trying to recruit myself to ORU. It was almost like they were, we don't know about this skinny little kid, and from this little Christian school, I'm begging to go. And Coach Self actually told me, he said, I didn't know you were going to be a good player. We needed a fourth body. We just happened to have a scholarship open up. And I was fortunate enough to go. And the weird thing about it was I actually, that was the same, the year I was being recruited, Liberty University made it to the NCAA tournament, played in North Carolina against Rasheed Wallace and Jerry Stackhouse. And I was just like, oh, I got to go to Liberty. And it's really down to those two schools. And ORU ended up being the school for me, and it actually ended up being a dream school, playing there for Coach Self. I mean, he's a brilliant coach, a great person to learn from, and I owe him so much even in my career after basketball, how kind he's been to me.
You know, what's interesting, though, is like you guys, people forget ORU was really, got really, really good during Self, your first 2 years. You didn't play very much. Tim Gill, Rocky Walls was just for that level. Cliff Crenshaw as well was a very good player, and Blake Moses as well. But you didn't. So okay, you didn't play very much your first 2 years till Barry took over. Let me start with Bill. What was he like as a coach? What were your first memories of your first kind of month of practice under Bill Self?
Honestly, it was incredible because coming from a coach's home, I loved thinking the game. And it was very normal for us to go have a film session. And after the film session, Coach Self turned off the old school VHS and start doing a whiteboard session. And he would do time, score, and momentum. And he would quiz us on how to put ourselves in the best situation, time, score, momentum at the end of the game. He would make us think. And here's the thing about Coach Self, I think people, they respect and they know about him, but being a player, I can tell you, he knows how to put his teams in a position, especially at the end of the game, not to make the shot. The kids have to make the shot. The player has to make the shot. But a coach's job is to put his team in the best situation. He's an absolute genius. I mean, the other day, I was watching them play, I think it was Texas Tech, and I saw him call a play in the huddle with like just a – in a game situation, and I saw one of the assistant coaches fist bump him because they knew they were putting in a wrinkle that they had not shown Tech, and they were going to get the look they wanted, and they did, and they scored it.
I'll tell you the other side of that one, okay? So that inbounds play they ran earlier in the game, and Texas Tech, this is one of those coaches can only do so much, because I talked to the Tech guys, they're like, we told them what play was coming, we told them how to play it, and they still screwed it up, right?
Yes.
Right. So it's really remarkable. You know, it's fascinating to me because, you know, ORU was, I had known about ORU, as you know, my dad went in the '70s when ORU kind of first took off, my dad was at Jacksonville, which is also, and UW-Milwaukee, which is also an independent. So they actually, I think, played against Oral Roberts, and, I remember your junior year. Okay. So yeah. I'm thinking it's your junior year, right? When you guys came in and played us at Gallagher. Yep. And what do you remember about the game?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because here's what I remember.
Okay.
I remember coming out for, I'd get there, you know, the guys that wanted to get some shots up, we get there about an hour early before the gym's full, and we get a few shots up. And I remember coming into Gallagher, Iowa, and it's a weird feeling because the stands were so vertical, and so I'm getting a few shots up, and I look down the court, and I remember this, Doug. It's so funny. You had on some gray Nike sweatpants and a wife beater, and I was like, "Who is this guy down there?" It looked like you had just done about three sets of curls because you were all biceped up, and I want people to know this. I don't think people respect how good of a player you were. I remember in the game going, this guy is going everywhere on the court. Now, it helped that you had a Desmond Mason and an Adrian Peterson and some guys that could make shots for it. But you were putting guys in positions, and you had a swag. You had an aura. I was like, man, I need to get some of those gray sweatpants and wear them like that.
So here's what I recall about it. Okay, so during that season, we were picked dead last in the Big 12.
Yeah,
right, dead last. And And the year before I got there, they were 17-15, two consecutive years, 17-15. And I think, did you guys beat them the year before? I'm trying to remember.
My sophomore year, we beat them at the Maybe Center. Sophomore year.
So they lost to, they got stomped by Tulsa and got beat by Oral Roberts, the two games in Tulsa. And, and then Bill took over the Tulsa job and coach came out with the, I'm not going to play against assistant coach, former assistant coaches anymore thing, whatever.
So
we come out and you guys were, everybody respected Tim Gill and like, man, Tim Gill's a really good player and we're undefeated. We hadn't played anybody. And Philip Owens was from Stillwater, was a freshman, right? And Barry Hinson, who was the head coach, but he had been a head coach at Stillwater High School, was an OSU alum or whatever. And it was a great basketball game. And we were down, I'm going to say like nine, maybe six, but not nine, with, you know, in the second half. And Phillip Owens checks into the game. And here comes this freshman. And so here's the way it worked. But our system at the time was, at every free throw we had, we called what defense we were in, what secondary we were in, what kind of offense we were in, and what 15-second play we were in. Every free throw. And, you know, like sometimes, and it would just like, you'd meet together and you just go, hey, same shit, right? And then we, and that's it. But I think it was 40 red was the call for press. So we saw Phillip Owens come in, right? And as you said, because we hadn't been very good, but we were winning. And because it was Oral Roberts and you guys brought some, the place is packed, it's, you know, 6,300 people in there.
Yeah.
And we put on the full court press. And I actually, afterwards, there was part of me that felt really bad for the kid, right? Here's, because in your mind, you think, well, man, I'm from Stillwater. That guy, those point guard, all those guys, they're playing in the position that I should be playing. Because I don't, no kid grows up in Stillwater and doesn't dream of playing for OSU, right? And
exactly.
When he's in high school, they won a national championship as well, or went to the Final Four as well. Before Barry could call a timeout, it was like a 6 or an 8-0 run. But here's how big the win was for us over you guys. That I don't know if you remember this. The last play of the game, Adrian Peterson steals the ball, throws it to me. I throw him an alley-oop. He catches it. He dunks it and hangs on the rim. And we win 73-66. We end up winning by 7 points after trailing by, I think, 9 points in the second half. The place goes crazy, and he, like, pulls himself up. Like, remember the end of White Man Can't Jump?
Yes.
When he pulls himself. That's what Adrian Peterson did on the rim. And we're, like, celebrating. And somebody goes, why are we celebrating? We only beat Oral Roberts. I was like, just go with it, man. Go with it. Anyway, it was out of the respect for your guys' program and the ass-kicking they took the year before.
Yeah, that's kind of you to say. We were at that point, we were a strong low major, mid major, and you know, we had some fun wins. We really did. We had a fun win against Arkansas at the Maybe Center during my career, and got to play in some incredible places. College basketball was, and Doug, I'm glad you mentioned the gym was packed. That was back in the day when you would go to a game. I mean, the student sections were unreal.
Yeah,
they were relentless. It was great.
I'll remember that. So that same year, we thought we played this crummy schedule, right? You guys win 20 games. Yeah. We played Washington, who went to the Sweet 16 at our place. They had Mount McCullough. Dan Dickow was a freshman. They had Donald Watts. They had Deion Luton, who I know you know. He's from Oklahoma, originally from Lawton, I believe, originally. Anyway, I remember going to that game, and I couldn't get into the gym because my dorm, Bennett Hall, was across the street. And so I come down, and I was running a little late, and we're supposed to be there, I don't know, like an hour and a half, 2 hours for the game. And it was like an hour 15 for the game. And I come in, and I just had a hoodie and a parka and sweats or whatever. And I was like, no, I'm on the – and no one knew who the hell I was. I'm, you know, I'm a, you know, sick, barely, not really 6 foot white guy. And I'm like, yo, I'm on the team. They're like, no. They're like, no. And I had to cut through the student section, and students are like, whoa, who do you think you are? What do you think you're doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing? Right? I'm like, yo, I'm on the team. No, you're not. Anyway, it was hard to get into the building as a player an hour before the game, let alone as a student. How do you think we get that back? Can we get that back?
$1 million. I don't, with Netflix and Prime Video, I don't see it coming back, bro. It's sad to say that. But you know, it's funny. I like watching a lot of different sports. The energy is not the same in college basketball, or I mean, it's not there. There's not that buzz. And I don't know how we get it back. I mean, international soccer to me has that energy, the community. We're losing that community in college sports, I think. I don't know. That's my opinion.
Well, I think there's a lot to do. A lot of different issues with it. I think there's this. Somehow we've gotten to this place where college sports is simply a way station for professional sports, right? That's a big thing. And the reality of it is it's not. And the reality, I don't think college basketball isn't as bad. I think it's hard right now because there's no fans there.
That's true.
And I do think, I think that the schools... We went through this process of this period where the one and dones maybe didn't dominate in terms of winning a national championship, but they played major roles in who the top teams were. I think that's going to end with this G League Select thing.
Yeah.
And I think now the reason the Big Ten is so good is they have the most four and five year players.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to help make the sport better and a little older. And also, you'll have guys who are like, yo, I've seen you play the last 3 years. I don't know. I don't know how we get it back to what I would say. I think the big problem is every game's on TV. Like, I remember, I mean, obviously, you're in independent and then a mid-con, and you didn't have a lot of televised games till maybe the conference tournament or the one-off game.
Right.
But like when I was at Notre Dame, like the reason I went to one reason I went to Notre Dame was like we have 18 nationally televised games. We're the only team to have NBC games. We had CBS games. We had ESPN games. Like now, basically, you can get any game ever anywhere in your major conference. There's nothing special about a TV game. Like I remember when Dick Vitale came to call a game at Notre Dame, or Bill Raftery came at Notre Dame or at Oklahoma State. And you're like, man, this is the biggest thing ever.
Yeah.
And now it doesn't feel that way. And
So the
proliferation of college sports on television, I think, has watered down the importance of a game. And why would you leave your dorm room or leave your apartment if you can watch all the games instead of watching one game? Part of that is there's not the connectivity to the university because kids are only there for a second and then they transfer out.
Yeah, it's true. You know, and I don't know how I'd like to ask you this question, Doug. Do you enjoy watching? I grew up going college basketball. And then the NBA, I loved the NBA, loved it. But college basketball was my thing.
Yeah.
And now I find myself loving the NBA game with the flow, the skill level, the ability to make shots. And how do you feel about it? Do you enjoy watching college basketball or NBA more?
I think it depends. I think this, you bring up a great point, which is, and I've discussed this with some college coaches, is some of them are starting to come around to it. Like you watch like Michigan State for a long time. Now they've got taken to running horns and stuff. Like their zone offenses was for a long time really rudimentary. And was, you know, just kind of old school, throw a guy in the high post and in the short corner, you know, and you're passing and standing and spacing and whatever. Whereas NBA teams is a little different attack versus zones. Obviously, zones are different in how you can play them within the NBA rules. Look,
sure.
I think the NBA game is, I think it's weird because the NBA can be hard to watch because sometimes you feel like the effort isn't what the effort. And now with no fans, it lacks some of the zip, but the actual skill level to it and the offensive coaching in it and even the defensive coaching in it is spectacular. So too is the skill. I think the challenge for college coaches is going to be who's going to be the guy who's going to be one at a school that's good enough and two is a big enough name to go like, hey, you know what? I'm going to start running NBA stuff. I'm going to play an NBA style. And roll the dice and see ultimately how it works. The problem with it is that I don't know if the spacing will ever be what it is
right.
in the NBA because the skill of shooting isn't what it is in the NBA, with the exception of the Iowas of the world.
That's so true. And I will say this, Gonzaga is pretty to watch. They are.
But what do they have? They have a mixture of transfers, four-year kids, and one great one and done. And you have a coach who... can kind of do, no one's firing Mark Few, so he can take some chances and try some things and run some different stuff. So, like, he's the perfect guy to try and continue to evolve and push the limits of what you want to do.
Great point.
But yes, I mean, like, look, there's sometimes where college basketball is that it can be a hard watch. But I think that's a hard watch because, again, there's too many teams. You're playing kids that are too young, and they can't make shots. And you're like, geez, this is...
That's what bothers me is the making shots. I don't see it at the college level. Like, in the NBA right now, I mean, you have guys who are making shots. Yes. I mean, it's high-level skill.
So do you put the NBA rules into college basketball and think maybe that helps it?
You know, I love that question, Doug. Here's what I'm a proponent of. I don't understand how we own this game. We own the game. It's America. I'm high on USA basketball, but why do we have three sets of rules? Why do we not have a shot clock universally in high school basketball? It's why don't we have, and I'm not saying that everybody should play the NBA rules. Maybe we should, but there should be some sort of universal rule that goes through our game that helps develop the decision-making, where guys become better decision-makers. I think that's the thing that people mess up with the shot clock. It forces you to make quicker, better decisions at a younger age. And we see that with the European players, in my opinion. I'd like to see them make some more adjustments on that.
So let's do this. Let's form the perfect college basketball rule system. Chad Wilkerson and Doug Gottlieb, we're on the committee. Okay.
Well,
do you want to go to the 20? I'll tell you what's better than the 24 clock, which I like. The 24 clock is fine. I used to be like, hey man, I want 30 or 35. But now I'm like, yeah. Okay. So when I coached internationally, do you know what I love the best? I love the 14-second reset. Love the 14-second reset. And one of the things that I coached when I've coached in international rules is anytime we get an offensive rebound, okay, unless you have a layup, we want to kick out. We want to get a three. Okay. We want to kick out. We want to get a three. And it's an idea that really I took from Davidson. Okay. So they used to do that. They used to practice it when Steph was there, was they would call them daggers. And anytime they get an offensive rebound, they're trying to find Steph. And if you watch the Warriors, they do the exact same thing. They try and find Steph. And then Duke, when they won the national title with John Shire in that crew, and Zubek was like the best offensive rebounder in basketball that year, they were doing the exact, they took that, what Davidson was doing, they started doing it. I love the 14-second reset. It, like, I don't want you pulling it out and setting it up and setting it. I want a 14-second reset. I think that's a good start. Chad Wilkerson, are you okay with that?
I'm 100% on that. I believe that. Let me ask you another international rule. How do you feel about the coaches being the only one that are able to call a timeout?
I like that. I don't like the has to be a dead ball thing. I don't mind the timeouts. I think you could cut the number of timeouts. But like, look, we're all saying how great the NBA game is. They have like almost unlimited timeouts. So I don't like the advance the ball rule. I don't think you need that in college basketball. I think, you know, like some of the great historic plays were ones that go the length of the court. You can just kind of figure it out. You can always throw it to half court and call a timeout like Roy Williams likes to do. Like, there's a million different ways you can do it. So I do like some difference. It's like football. Like, hash marks are different. Some of the timing and mechanisms are different. Generally, the rules of the game are the same. I'm okay. Like, I would like the NBA to go to the 1-on-1. How does the NBA have the lane is wider to make it more difficult to post up, right? The three-point line is the furthest to make it more difficult. 8 seconds to get it across midcourt, which, by the way, I would be okay if college basketball wanted to do that. I think it would have teams press more, be maybe a little bit more enjoyable to watch, but whatever. But all of a sudden, they're the only ones that don't have the 1-on-1. No. Give them if they can deal with the most pressure, they can deal with the most pressure at the free throw line. Go to 1-on-1.
I like that. Now we're getting a little bit of compromise on both ends, and we're kind of meeting in the middle to optimize the game for every level. And here's what I've always said to people, especially with the shot clock and being a high school coach and small college coach, people would always say, listen, I've watched 14 and under and 12 under games in Budapest, Hungary, where they have a shot clock and they have a shot clock operator, and the kids learn how to play with it. It's possible. You know, and so you have all these people saying, I think you're spot on with the 24 second, with the 14 second reset. I think that changes the game at the college and high school level for better production from our young guys on decision making. You can't just dribble it 20 times. I hate watching high school basketball where one individual player has the liberty to dribble the ball 20 times.
Now, in fairness, you did say how much you love NBA basketball. There are a couple of NBA players that dribble the shit out of the ball, and it's hard to watch.
Yeah, that's true.
So you get done. Go ahead.
You dribbled it a few times to yourself, but you all.
I would say this. There has never, before Lonzo, I would say there's never been a guy who's advanced past the basketball. I really like to advance the ball, and you know it's one of those. And I have an 11-year-old son, and we talk about this all the time. Like, you got a KYB, can't throw it to that guy if he can't dribble, but this guy you got to throw it to some kind. You know, I had Joe Atkins. Joe Atkins was like, I'm always open. Like, I understand, but if I throw it to you, you're going to shoot it. So I have to sometimes be judicious. If I threw it to Desmond, especially early in his career, like as long as he didn't have to dribble it. And then there was, because he did not have the tightest handle in the world. But if you threw it anywhere close to the rim, he would fight any human being for the basketball and find a way to dunk it, right? And
Doug,
so
let me ask you this too. Let me ask you. I think you were ahead of your time in this, and correct me if I'm not thinking this right. But you, if I remember correctly, you were one of the only guys, and you did it all the time, where you would penetrate to the lane and keep your dribble alive. And I know Steve Nash started doing that. With the Suns, and you were able to make interior passes as you kind of looped under the basket, and not a lot of guys were doing it back then.
Yeah, I would say the couple things that I did, and I don't remember being taught to do it. Was baseline drive, baseline drift, right? Was throw to the weak side baseline, and then the ability to have people that are cutting, moving. While you're, I think Villanova probably does the best job, but they do jump stops in the lane. And I never jump stop in the lane. I never, never. I also am like one of these guys where I remember John McLeod, like, hey, he pulled me aside one time. He's like, when I tell everybody to not pass the ball with one hand, I'm not talking to you. I'm like, I understand, coach. Right. And I'm like, people are like, well, don't jump up in the air when you don't know where you're going with it. Like, yeah, okay, that sounds good. But I don't know. Teaching passing is, I mean, you as a coach now, I can teach guys to be better passers. I can't teach them to see things. Can you?
It's shocking. It's shocking. In fact, even in with Impact Hoops, when I'm doing skill development, I've actually implemented some passing drills. I just don't, kids don't drill it. Kids don't practice it. And it's shocking if you just do a little bit if a corner shooter lifts, it's shocking how bad kids are at passing on time on target with movement. And I grew up playing soccer, and I learned that in soccer of I can't pass it to the person, I got to pass it to where the person's going to be. And I think that as coaches, especially with younger players, we need to drill that. We need to help them develop that, because and be honest, there's some kids who just have it. They have the timing, they have the vision, they have the skill set. And that's who you want the ball in the hands of most of the time. But we could do a better job of helping young players at least practice it to where they're proficient at finding windows and finding guys on time, on target. I love what John McLeod did there with you, because I think that's brilliant coaching. Here's what I tell kids. I used to tell my last high school team, you can make any pass you want if it's completed. Be as creative as you want to be if it's completed. Now, if you do some jack wagon passing, it's a turnover. You can sit by me. But I love the creativity of basketball. And when you have a player that's skilled to do it, I love coaches who release guys to do that.
So here's what I tell kids. Here's what I tell my kids about passing. And no matter what age, as I ask somebody, do you know what the golden rule is? And they start talking in basketball terms. Like, no. Do you know what the golden rule is? So finally you get some kid that like meekly say like, do unto others as you want done unto you. Like, yes, it is. Okay. So I want you to think about that in terms of passing. They're like, what do you mean? I was like, do you want to pass at your toes, or do you want a pass that's crisp, firm on the seams at your chest? Do you want somebody to burn somebody out where you throw it too hard, or do you want the right pace? And they all know I was like, all right, well, if you want that, then do that to your teammates, because Nothing in basketball, the only thing more contagious than COVID is selfishness or unselfishness, right?
Yeah.
If you take a bad shot, then he's going to take a bad shot. Then he's going to if you give a bad pass and be like, man, F you, I'm going to give you a, like, if you give somebody like that, if you become an one more team, one more pass team, you'd be amazed at how everybody would, they just kind of fall in line and do unto others as a passer as you want done unto you. All right. So you mentioned coaching. You get done playing at ORU, played for Barry. Guys don't make the NCAA tournament, but it's a good program. First, I have to ask, like, what was it like to go to ORU for people who, you had the tie rule, right? Didn't you have to have a tie in class?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you weren't allowed to curse or drink and no premarital sex. Like, what was that? It was not my experience in college.
Right.
What was your experience in college like at ORU?
Yeah, it's different. It was definitely different, but it's something that I had chosen. And here's the interesting thing about having an experience at a religious school. The two things. Number one, you get these world-class speakers come in. And you know, and to be quite honest with you, we had a one-seat rule in chapel. All the basketball players, we had one seat in between us so we could lay out and take a nap if we needed to. So it wasn't like we're sitting there taking notes. But the interesting thing is you have these world-class speakers, and now I want to pay $225 to go hear John Maxwell speak in Atlanta when we were getting those guys weekly. And so it's a different experience. The second thing is lifelong friends. I've got five of my teammates at Oral Roberts. Five of them have churches now. And they're incredible fathers. They're incredible husbands. They're not perfect, but they've given their life to serve others. And the fruit of that and the deep relationships I have. I mean, like when I look back at my sophomore year, the Earl McClellans, the Tim Gills, the Rocky Walls, the guys you mentioned, they're like brothers to me. I mean, it's, and you know this, Doug, there's nothing like a locker room to bring people together from different socioeconomic, from different cultures, from different races. A locker room is one of the most special places on earth. And the experience at ORU on the basketball team was awesome because I had the ORU experience, but I also had the Division I basketball experience, and that was a dream for me. And to play for a Hall of Fame coach, and just to kind of put a cherry on top, 3 years ago my phone rang, and Coach Self didn't call me very often, but we have a relationship, and it was Coach Self, and he said, "Hey Chad, I want that group of basketball players from ORU to come to the Hall of Fame induction, and I'm going to pay for you guys to come." And so he said, "Can you call some of the guys?" And I called the guys, and every one of them said yes. And he was so honoring of us. Here's a man who's won a national championship and is at the pinnacle of college basketball. And for him to give us, a moment of respect at Oral Roberts University, you know. I can't say enough good things about Oral Roberts University and my experience there. I would do it all over again.
I'll just say this, like, Bill told me he'll come on the pod and we'll do it. I'm doing a Kansas game later this year, so we're going to sit down and it'll probably be a long one. I find him to be the best. Like, again, not a guy that's without flaw, right? He doesn't, he'll curse, he'll ride dudes, he'll tell everybody his team is soft. And then when you say his team is soft, you'd be like, man, who said that? Why would you say that, you know, like publicly or whatever? Like, he's not a flawless human being. But I like, of the people I would love to play for in college basketball, he and Chris Beard are two of my absolute favorites because they're just real. They're real and they're genuine, and they never forget the people who worked hard for them, and you're kind of part of their family. I never played for Bill Self. I don't know if you know this. This is a true story. And I'll see if he ever got it. When I got done playing at Oklahoma State, I wrote him a letter. And I said, Coach, you know, like, if that year we both went to the Elite Eight, we never played each other against Tulsa. We only played them pickup ball. We had to come to the Reynolds Center. Their guys wouldn't come up to our place. And, but I wrote him a letter saying, like, look, I want to play as long as I can play. I might go into broadcasting, but I'd love to coach with you someday. And I went into kind of reasons why. And it's real. Like, I really genuinely like him as a human being, and I think he's an incredible basketball coach. And that's it's interesting, kind of the ties of that, and of course our ties in the USBL. last thing, and this is something I haven't asked you, is if I remember correctly, I think you led the state in scoring in Texas like twice. Like, how do you mentally go from like leading the state of Texas in scoring to not playing early in your career? How did you manage those emotions?
That's a great question. I give a lot of credit to my dad. I played with a freedom that most players don't get. And here's the cool thing about playing for your dad, and I hope to provide this for my son someday. I have three little boys, 5, 4, and 1, and one on the way. Here in 3 months, we'll have our fourth boy. And I want to provide. Here's what I had with my dad, and I played with him. I don't know if you remember this. We played with athletes first when they used to play ex-college players, do exhibition. I played for my dad there a little bit there as a 23-year-old. And had some of my best games. Here's what I had. I had this unconditional love. And my dad's a wonderful man of God and wonderful, like, human, unbelievable, just integrity, great, but a competitive monster. Wants to just, you play Uno, he wants to beat your brains out. And my dad created this competitive drive inside my brother and I, but wrapped around that competitive drive was this unconditional love. Like, I knew that if I screwed up, it didn't change how he felt. And so as a coach, I'm trying to figure out, as a trainer, as a coach, how can I provide that for young people? Because when they feel safe inside a relationship and they feel like they can fail forward, you can get some really magical moments. And so I had magical moments all throughout my high school career. But then when I got to ORU, and I give credit to my teammates, the older guys, the James Cruises, the Oral McClellans, I felt like a brother. And so when we were playing Arkansas at Bud Walton, and Kareem Reed made a buzzer beater shot to beat us by one, I didn't play but 3 minutes that game. I felt completely a part of the game. I felt completely a part of the team. When Cliff Crenshaw made a three, I felt like I had done my job in practice guarding him. Like, there was a deep.
Yeah, but you're also a coach's son, right? But you're also, you're a coach's son, but I always struggle with that. Like, I don't know if I told this story. So my junior year, so my sophomore year, we surprised everybody. My junior year, we were like top five in the country preseason, and we had lost Brett Robish, who was our starting center. It was awesome. Chad Alexander was kind of a glue guy, but returned everybody else. And we added Glennon Alexander, who had transferred in at mid-year, who also led the state in scoring in the state of Texas, all-time leading scorer in the state of Texas, high school basketball history. So everybody thought, like, we're going to be better, and he was eligible mid-year. And Glennon was a handful for our team chemistry even when he wasn't playing. And I was playing great. And then I got a technical in a loss to Florida Atlantic. We beat TCU, who was nationally ranked, Lee Nalon, whatever. And then we played Florida Atlantic, and I got a technical, and we went from, it was like we were down three, and we inbounded the ball, and I thought I got fouled, and like I had like a scratch across my face, and they go lay the ball in, and I look at the ref, and I'm like, that's a fucking foul, right? Yeah. And he tees me up. They make two free throws. It was like here's what it was. It's a one-point game. They get the steal. It's a three-point game. You get the technical foul, make both free throws. It's a five-point game. I come out of the game, and they score another bucket. It's a seven-point game. Now we're down seven to shitty-ass Florida Atlantic, right? and so we came back, and we had a chance to win the game, and we did. It was a crazy sequence of events, and we didn't win. I had 8 points and 18 assists.
Yeah.
But I was, because I got the tee, like, you know, obviously coach was pissed, and we had an 81 game non-conference home winning streak.
Oh,
so that Saturday we got fly out. We're playing in Anaheim, which is, a 5 minute drive from my house I grew up in, to play UCLA, where my sister had been a cheerleader. My brother went to school.
Wow.
They had offered me a scholarship. I turned them down. And then the first time around or whatever, and we had season tickets as kids. We're playing UCLA, and it's Baron Davis's first game back in the pond. And I get a tee early in the game. There's a ref named Charlie Range. Charlie Range was a horrible homer official. He was awful. And early in the game, we're not getting any calls. And I swear to God, this is all I said. I was like, come on, Charlie, we got to even him up a little bit, right? Like, I flipped the ball. But here I am, a college kid, going like, we need to even him up a little bit. And he teased me. And we're like, what?
Yeah.
So then end of the half, it's like a two-point game. And we run, 1-4 flat because I got Barron on me, and he's not. It's again his first game back. He's heavy. He's not moving great. I go past Barron, and they got Dan Gedzurich and Jerome Moiso, and I take him up, and I think I can shoot a floater instead of just dishing the ball off or whatever. And I mean, that thing got rejected to like midcourt. Barron leaks out. He gets a layup. He lays it in. And then he comes back talking shit, you know, yeah, motherfucker. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And like does the bump shoulders with me. Right. And so I bump. I was like, get out of my face, dude. That's all I said. And he takes a dive. Ah, and the refs turn around. They just see him taking a dive. They assume. So they call an intentional foul. He makes two free throws. We go into the locker room. The refs come in. They're like, that intentional foul occurred before the buzzer went off. It's a technical foul. He's out of the game. It's second technical foul. So I have to sit in the locker room. We lose by three, and I'm in the doghouse now, like buried with a bone. And like I'm here, I'm in California, only game, and I don't even make it past the halftime.
Yeah.
So the next eight games, I came off the bench. That year I led the country in scoring, in assist. I only averaged 26 minutes a game because the next eight games I played like single-digit minutes for the only time in my career. Never in my career. Anyway, so one game we're playing Southeast Missouri State. I think I played 8 minutes. And we're struggling, because we're playing without a point guard, right? We end up, end of the game, Adrian Peterson gets an open three right in front of the bench, hits it. It kind of takes us from like 8 to 11, and we're going to win the game, right? So the next day we come in, emergency film session. Everybody has to be there at 7 a.m. I'm like, dude, we just won. We played like crap, but I'm barely playing. Like, we're working through some things. Like, why do we have a film session? We just won. So we come in, and we're not watching the whole game. We're watching one clip, and it's Adrian Peterson hitting the shot. So we go around, and we said, they go around the room, and they start asking everybody, like, what do you see here? And, like, guys are like, man, Pete's got his feet set. We ran the play right. It's a big bucket. Everybody jumps up. So they take, remember those laser pointers?
Yeah.
Okay, so they take a laser pointer and they circle me on the bench. All the coaches are taking me, and I'm the only guy that doesn't get up when he makes the three.
Oh, buddy.
Right? Well, and why? Because I was pissed, right? Like, I'm sitting here like, yo, I'm, and the lesson was like, hey, man, you either cheer for your teammate or go find another team. That was really it. So then we go out in the court, and then they run everybody else. Doug's more important than the rest of us. Doesn't care about you guys. You guys just run. Like, run them to their ankles, smoke. That was coach. So that's how that was a lesson that it only took me one time to learn, but I learned that one because I was a bit of a powder. That was really why I didn't shoot, because if I missed, he would take me out. So I was like, all right, screw it. I just won't shoot because I hated coming out of games. And I just always, you were a great high school player, great, and you had to sit and wait your turn. I just always wondered how you had that in you.
Doug, I gotta ask you if you remember this, because I don't think I watched you shoot as a teammate at the Athletes First in the USBL, and I knew you. I was like, man, he makes shots. I don't know if you remember this. We were at Texas Tech.
Yes.
We were playing for Athletes First.
Yes.
You and I get out there at the court about an hour before, and tell me if I'm thinking this wrong. We get out there about an hour, and they have like 20 just Dumaflachi fraternity brothers that show up an hour early, and they want to taunt you every time you shoot. They want to yell, brick, brick, brick. And so they're just trying to play, and you're kind of playing games with them. You're making shots, but then you'd go hit the rim a couple times, and they'd go, brick, 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 brick. And I remember the game starting, and you're a starter, of course. We had a good little squad there. We had some guys who ended up being pros over in Europe, including yourself and myself. And I remember early in the game against Tech, you catch the ball in the deep corner right in front of the student section, and you just raise up to shoot a three. And I'm going, oh, my gosh, Duck's just ripping a three. You raise up, you shoot it, snap your wrist, you swish it. And this is before Twitter or Instagram.
I know the story.
I've told you. Turn around to the student section and double bird them on your way back down the court. That was so classic.
But I think now your dad was the coach, right?
Yes.
Okay, so your dad. So actually, I didn't double bird him. This is a true story.
Okay,
here's what happened. I hit the three, and I did the hand like if there was a TV camera, you couldn't see it. And then when I lift was. You on the way down the court, right, to all the, and they were dying. So your dad takes me out of the game, and he goes, it's a great shot. Okay. It's a great shot, and I love the attitude. Okay, but we don't do the finger. We don't do the finger. And I was like, yeah, my bad. Sorry about that one. All right, how many? Can you name the teams that we played?
Oh man, Stephen F. Austin, Texas Tech, OU.
I don't remember Stephen F. I think we did Stephen F. I didn't play in the OU game because I played, I don't know if you remember this, so I played with my dad's squad, then I played with you guys, and then I played 20 games in 22 days, and the culmination was I played against Carolina with EA Sports, and Drew Barry was my teammate, and we had the lead at the half. And we played in Carmichael where Jordan played, and it was so much fun. So much fun. And we just got homered and lost. So I remember we played Texas State, which was Southwest Texas State back then, right? The Bobcats. They had the big wall right behind one of the hoops. It was a huge wall, weird gym. We played North Texas together. We beat them. We beat North Texas in the Super Pit. We beat Texas State. We lost to Tech, and we beat SMU. I'm trying to think who else we played. I didn't play the OU.
Here's the crazy part. We beat OSU that year, and you weren't at that game. We went and played in Enid so that the Enid people could see OSU, I guess. So we go play in the Coliseum in Enid. We're playing OSU. We give Coach Sutton his only exhibition loss in the history of his career. He was ticked. And Tim Gill played out of his mind. I actually had 36 or 37 that game. And that game was back when you used to send VHS over to Europe.
Yeah.
My first European contract came from the game in Enid against Oklahoma State where we handed them their only exhibition loss. So my apologies to OSU, but it did help me get a contract in Europe. It's so funny to think about. My kids ask, hey, you know, Dad, what about your game? Like, my games weren't on YouTube. It was it's like VHS was gold back then. You know, if you could, hey, can I get the film after the game to send over to, you know, to Russia, to China, to, you know, you're going up to Kinko's and get, it's a different world now.
When you got, where your first overseas spot was where?
Budapest, Hungary.
What was that like?
Actually played against Adrian Peterson.
He played there. I think they won, his team won the league.
Yeah, we hung out a little bit. He was a great, great human being, a great player, on my word. Could play.
Oh man. I mean, I don't think people know when you say Adrian Peterson, everybody thinks the running back, you know, and even I think Desmond would have been like, in terms of just a college player, in terms of skill, Pete was the best I ever played with. Desmond just played hard and was crazy athletic and competitive. Yeah. Pete was so good. Of course, he tore his knee in the Chicago pre-draft. He actually, Corey Carr was my teammate in Israel my second year. Corey got hurt, tore his ACL, and Pete came, replaced him. And the team was so cheap, they were supposed to get him his own apartment. He stayed with me for like two months, and then I left because they were killing me with they were starting to get crazy with the money. And Pete, I left Pete used my car and kept my apartment and everything. I mean, he's an all time great guy who's now a father and works for he's a head of finance down at a Toyota dealership down in Fort Worth.
Awesome.
Budapest. Best thing about Budapest is what?
The food, goulash. I had a little restaurant next to my apartment, which we called the flat. It was a grandmother, mother, and a daughter, three making food for people with eight seats in the little restaurant. They'd make homemade food every day. I never cooked in Budapest. I ate there three meals a day. They became like my family. The food was, it's real food, man. It's like moms and grandmas making real food. That was special.
Okay, so your second year was where?
I was in London, England, London Towers.
Was Nick Nurse your coach?
No, Nick was with the Brighton Bears. Nick was our assistant coach with the so I go way back with Nick. He was our assistant coach with the Oklahoma Storm. Mm-hmm. He was the head coach of the Brighton Bears, and you'll remember these guys. Nick had Sterling Davis from Tulane.
Yep.
And he had Randy Duck.
Yeah, I remember Randy Duck.
Oldest
dudes.
Yeah. Randy Duck and Sterling Davis became like celebrities in England. They were like on the MTV Music Awards for England. They had so much pop out there. And, you know, and who knew Nick Nurse would end up being a championship NBA coach. It's a small basketball world. You know that.
Randy came and joined. So here's how in Enid in 2000, we played. We had like five OSU guys, and Brian Gates was our coach. And yep. Brian was, he was like the assistant who the head coach quit like the day before the first game. And then I was late to shoot around, so I didn't start. Right. And, but that was a fun year. We had a squad. So then the year we played together, the Oklahoma Storm, or the half year before I quit, I was playing in the ABA. I left Israel. I went to play for a guy named Maz Track, who I'd known, and I felt like he fixed me, right? Like he got me, he got me right as a player, and I played in the ABA, and we were set to go to the ABA playoffs, and James Bryant was the owner of the Oklahoma Storm. So he told me, like, I think everybody made like between 500 and 1,000 a week or something with the Storm. So what he did was he said, like, look, I want you to be the face of my team. I'm going to pay you $2,500 a week, okay? And I'm going to pay your wife, put her on salary with our ticket sales.
I remember.
But you have to be at training camp. So I got there and Kareem didn't like me, and I had never even met Kareem. Just didn't like me, and I think he didn't like me because he didn't like James Bryant, and James Bryant was telling him, you know, this is your point guard, and so he wouldn't start me. And so it was me, you, and remember we had a teammate named Gabe Frank. Gabe's now a doctor in North Carolina. And we'd come off the bench, and it was like our plus minus was crazy. Yeah. It was crazy. It was a joke, right? And I remember we were playing in Oklahoma City at the Myriad, and I had played great the night before, and I played really, really, really well. And I just felt like I felt so defeated because I would do a radio show in the middle of the day, and then I put, you know, so much effort, and I was like I maxed out at like 20 minutes in a game, and you know, like I just you know what, fuck it, I'm done. I'm not gonna play for this dude anymore. But we did have some. Do you remember the Salina when I got into it with Kareem? I vaguely remember it. Other guys who are on that team remember it. I don't remember it that well.
Well, I actually got into it with Kareem also. And after you had left the team, I had a similar experience, you know, where the fans would be begging for me to get in the game. I'd get in the game, and then Kareem would jerk me. And I like to say good things about everyone. And so I'm going to say this. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar scored the most points in the history of the game. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is a brilliant book writer. He's a brilliant thinker. He's a brilliant man. I did not enjoy playing basketball for him, per se. But he won a championship. We won a championship. But I got into it with him in practice during a shoot-around, and he actually kicked me off the team. And I went back to Grand Prairie, Texas, and was substitute teaching at my dad's school. And James Bryant called me and said, hey, we need a shooter. Come on back. And I said, I don't know. And again, and I didn't get $2,500 a month, but he bumped me up a few hundred a week and say, get back here. But I do remember this, Doug. We had so much talent on that team. Ira Clark, Corey Brewer. I mean, it was a pros. I mean, it was, you know, and Kareem won a championship. He's a world championship USBL coach. I tell people all the time, that movie, what is it called, Semi-Pro with Colin Farrell? Yeah. What was his name? With Will Ferrell?
Yeah.
That was a semi-true story. It's the USBL.
Oh yeah!
That's exactly what happened.
How about this is my first year. We're with this team, and we've been at training camp, whatever. And I remember my dad telling me, like, and I was like, Dad, these guys are so good, like they're so good, and because we had Willie Burton, we had Bubba Wells, we had Darren McClinton was the other point guard. We had all these guys that played. That had a cup of coffee, or I mean, Willie Burton scored 50 points in the NBA game, and I was like, man, how are these? Why are these guys in Enid, Oklahoma, making $500 a week? Right? My dad said, like, son, there's always a reason. Okay, now I'm not going to name names of, but it, within the very first game of the history of the Oklahoma Storm, I saw the reason for like all of them. right? For like all of them. Like one guy was literally rolled out of the strip club, which was in our parking lot of our Holiday Inn to go to the game, and then went there immediately afterwards. One guy was at the Sonic parking lot, you know, having two cheeseburgers and a Route 44 Coke for the game. One guy was women. One guy, it was food. One of the guys was just batshit crazy, right? Yeah. One of the guys that wouldn't pass, couldn't get along with others. Like, there's always a reason. And that team got to the finals. We lost Sean Colson, was great. We lost in a close game. But that was a fascinating, fascinating experience. Okay, so Budapest, Hungary. Then you go to London. Best thing about playing in London?
My mom travels the world as an international director for a nonprofit. London's her favorite place. I'm not a big fan. I didn't get down with London. The weather, the next year I went to Portugal. So I'm going to skip London. I'm going to go straight to Lisbon, Portugal. I live 15 minutes from the beach, 25 minutes from the number one casino in Portugal. No, Lord forgive me. I frequent the casino a little bit, for some activities there. When I was a pro in Portugal, Lisbon was unreal. And then my last year, I played in Istanbul, Turkey. That's a crazy city.
Crazy.
Just a crazy place. And to think that, you know, the game of basketball would take me all over. I played in the Philippines with Dennis Rodman right before we went to North Korea with those other guys. I did the same
thing. No way. Really?
Yeah. It was Alex English, Daryl Dawkins, Calvin Murphy, Otis Birdsong, Sidney Moncrief, and Dennis Rodman was our headliner. And it was Kareem Reed, Olufamatimi, another guy, young guy, and myself and a guy named Colin Boddicker. Colin is the color guy for TCU basketball now. And we went over, and I could tell you stories for days about that trip, but it was
give me one.
Basketball.
Give me one.
I'll give you one. I'll give you one here. So Dennis Rodman, he's 42 or 43 years old. We're only going to play two games. We're going to play the Filipino national team, and we played them in front of 14,000 people. It was unreal. But before we played them, we had to play an exhibition game in Cebu City, which was a 40-minute plane ride. So typical fashion, our promoter says, hey, be down in the lobby. We're staying at the Shangri-La Hotel. Best hotel I've stayed in is in Manila. Unreal. We're in the lobby. He said, be down there at 10. So we get down. Five of us are down there at 10 a.m. You know, I don't know, the flight was at noon. 20 minutes later, about, you know, 10 of us are there. Then finally the last guy, well, everyone's there except for who?
Dennis Rodman.
Dennis Rodman. Right. And Dennis traveled with a handler and a bodyguard at the time. And we know the bodyguard wasn't there, the handler, they were all up in his room, in his suite. He had this big suite. And so they were sending bellmen up there. They were sending people. They're beating on the door. Nobody's coming out of the door. Now it's 10:45. Now it's almost 11. Our promoter, who I think was paying Dennis, you know, around $150,000 a game, is going just crazy in the lobby, cursing. Yeah, he's asking Daryl Dawkins, what's wrong with this guy? And just going nuts. And we're going to have to get on the tour bus and go to the airport. And so we're waiting till the last second. We're in this beautiful, it's marble white flooring. It's just... And about 25 yards from where we're all, you know, these guys are NBA legends. Alex English, Daryl Dawkins, these guys are pro. One millisecond before we're about to walk out of the lobby, you hear the elevator doors. Ding! And Dennis Rodman walks out of the elevator with two Filipino hookers on each side, and he's in a towel. And all 10 or 12 of us that were in the lobby there kind of just paused and just kind of froze. And Dennis yells over to the group. He goes, hey, who wants to go to the hot tub? And, of course, we're all getting paid to play. Nobody says a word. Hey. We walk out and get on the tour bus. Dennis goes to the hot tub. So we get on the tour bus. We're getting carted through Manila, which is crazy traffic. We get to the airport. We're unloading all the bags and everything. And we walk into the airport. We're about to go through security. And in comes Dennis Rodman in some pajama pants, Ed Hardy hat, T-shirt, flip-flops, walks up right to the group and was like, hey, what's up, guys? And I look at Dennis, and I'm like, Dennis, what? How? He goes, the hot tub was great. Why didn't you come? I said, Dennis, we're getting paid to play basketball. I said, how'd you get here? he said, well, I hopped on the motorcycle with the police chief of Manila, and he just sped through traffic and got me here.
That's amazing. That's amazing. That trumps slightly my, we flew into Missouri and we got delayed because of weather, and what's the Olive Garden in Columbia, Missouri. And we go and sit down, and the waitress comes out and says, I'm sorry, sir, we don't have any food. And he's like, you tell Eddie Sutton his boys are hungry. We had a pool. we had a reservation. They're like, for 2 hours ago, we got delayed, and the chefs were going home, and the manager starts making spaghetti in the kitchen. That Dennis Rodman getting the police chief of Manila trumps it ever so slightly.
Dennis is a great human being too. He treated us like gold. I have nothing but good things to say to him. He's a lost soul in some ways, but he's also a loving, kind human being. And I experienced that firsthand. He treated me like gold. Now, Doug, talk about anniversary. I had just gotten married, and the sports promoter 3 months later says, hey, we need you over in the Philippines. And my wife made me promise that I wouldn't go out to the club with Dennis Rodman. And I'm proud to say I did not go to the club with Dennis Rodman. That's why I'm still married 15 years later. All is well. But it was a great experience. Basketball takes you into some of the craziest experiences and people. It was wonderful.
Yeah, so Willie Burton was my teammate with the USBL. And so when we needed a wing in Russia that the next winter, I was like, man, you guys should get Willie Burton. That dude can get buckets. He's in great shape. And so Willie was paranoid. For one, he's a recovering alcoholic at the time, but he was paranoid about everything, but really the Russians. And he tried to convince me that they were really spying on him. Don't let anybody clean your apartment. They'll plant the things. So he used to give me 1,000 rubles to gamble with him and to make sure that he didn't drink and to make sure that nobody messed with him. And he would give me every so, like, I was super cheap and I was on a budget and I just got married. And so I was like, cool, you can give me, we were roommates on the road, and give me 1,000 rubles to go gamble with him. And like, when I'd run out, he'd be like, here's 1,000 more, whatever, just don't leave. And I wasn't allowed for him. I wasn't allowed to. I'm like, Willie, I'm not a stay out. I'm not a hangout guy, dude. I need to go to bed. He's like, no, man, you're my guy. This is what you do. So, it does take you to some crazy, crazy, crazy places. Okay. I want to get to what you're doing now in terms of service. I know you're working with Impact Basketball, but you're doing something else with books. Tell me about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty cool. About four and a half years ago, I partnered with my co-founder, Casey Stewart. He's a incredible entrepreneur there in LA, and he produces world-class videos. And we just came up with this idea that, you know, there's kids who books and education can be so transformational, but that married with sports is something that could be kind of neat. So we started Bookin' a Ball. It's bookinaball.org, and we just started simply. And here's the cool thing about it: we don't have when people give to our 501c3, it all goes to books and balls because we all have A jobs. We all work. This is like our side mission. No one takes a salary. No one takes money from it. We just simply buy a lot of times soccer balls. But here's the cool thing, Doug. When you give a kid a book, you know, we give them adventure books and books on hope and books on, you know, to inspire them. It's pretty neat. But when you see a 7-year-old kid who has nothing and you hand him a $7 McGregor soccer ball, and he thinks that he just hit the world-class lottery because he has his own ball. Sports brings a joy in children like no other thing, in my opinion. It's something about a ball. And I can tell you story after story of our times in Ecuador, Zimbabwe, Sudan, all these different places we've been able to go and partner with other people to give these soccer balls, basketballs. When we go to Asia, we do basketballs, which is kind of neat because I like basketball, but we do a lot of soccer balls. It just brings a joy, and it gives us a chance to say, hey, and this is the neat thing. My brother has adopted 3 African children. He has 5 children. 3 are from Africa, and I call him the varsity squad. I'm the JV squad. I'm sending materials and spending my time and resource there, but I haven't adopted. But what we want to do is I just, for one moment, I want to tell these young people, I see you. We see you. You matter. you have potential. You have gifts. And so we do it with the soccer ball, basketball, and inspirational books. And Doug, here's the neat thing about it. You know this. When you're a high-level athlete, now I was an NBA player. I got close but didn't make it. But I experienced some incredible highs in sports. It almost seems like it's hard for guys to keep chasing that experience, that what brings me that deep satisfaction that playing against the UCLA. And I'm telling you, Doug, when I hand a ball to a 7-year-old orphan, it's like a game-winning shot over and over again, bro. Yeah, so no, I'm blessed.
I do have a question. How do I get my son? I get my kids books for Christmas, yeah. and I try and get them ones that I think, but they can all. My son is in this like I hate reading thing.
Yeah.
Any advice?
No, patience. I hated reading, Doug. I read every Cliff Note in high school. I never read a book in high school. I was salutatorian, just because I could memorize notes. I get to college. I don't like reading. But my mom and dad birthed a little bit of, like, they planted a few, just plant seeds. I get to Budapest, Hungary, and I'm tired of watching Animal Planet 24 hours a day. I only got like 3 stations. I'm tired of watching Crocodile Hunter. I pick up a book and I go, oh my gosh, I'm 23 and now I'm falling in love with books. So patience, man. Let him be a kid. Let him have fun. Plant seeds though. And that's what we're doing with Book and the Ball. We're not doing major work, man. I'm not blind to that. But we're planting seeds, man. Just plant seeds.
All right, I got 2 more. One, how can somebody donate to Book and the Ball?
It's simple. My partner, Casey Stewart, is a world-class producer of videos and stuff, and he made us a really nice website, bookandtheball.org. It's all right there. You just click donate. And it's simple. We made it simple to do. It's just a few clicks. And again, man, I always tell people, if you want to give to a Book and a Ball, it's pretty neat because it's all going to the exact mission, and we're gonna continue doing that. I mean, we're just gonna buy books and balls, and we partner with people to distribute it all over the world. I partner with a group out of Florida that's world class with the books. It's just so bookandaball.org, bookandaball.org, and you can follow us on social media. We got all that stuff too. Doug, thank you so much for letting me just
share. Hold on. I haven't gotten my last question yet.
I love it.
Okay. Obviously with COVID, you haven't been able to travel. Right. Do you know where your first trip is going to be once everything opens up?
No, we don't. And that is all in flux right now. It's very, as you know, man, it's very, especially international travel. We've actually done a lot of domestic things lately. We just did a project in Mexico because we could get there. We don't know, but I will tell you this: when we find out, you'll be the first to know.
Okay, because I want to go on one of these trips. That was the other part, and I'd like to bring one of my kids, if potentially my son, whatever. I want him to see what the rest of the world lives like, because they get a complete different view of how their life is. In comparison, Chad, I'm honored to call you a friend. I'm glad we got a chance to catch up. We will do so more in the future. Maybe pop you on when I got self on the pod. In the meantime, have a happy and safe new year. Congratulations on the upcoming birth of another son.
Yes.
And, and if you want to name him Doug, that's all cool too, as well. Right. Like it was like,
we're
man, I was going to name
him Rip. We're naming Rip. Him Rip. Rip. We got an ace, a pierce, a gunner, and now a Rip. The Stallions are destined for greatness. But just like you, you know what I'm excited about? It's right. Taking them on these trips.
Oh, it's the best.
To get a perspective on the world and to be a caring, loving human being.
It's awesome, man. Hey, listen, have a blessed new year. Thanks
you
for
too,
joining.
Buddy. Appreciate your time.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tell my UCLA recruitment story in a different pod, and we will talk about it. It'll be great. I think you'll really, really like it. I want to do this. I want to offer up my Twitter handle, @GottliebShow. You follow me on Instagram, same thing. We have lots of good pods coming out. You're going to really enjoy it. In the meantime, send me questions, whatever you want covered, guests that you want. I got good ones upcoming for you. And have a happy new year. Look, we're almost out of this thing. Obviously, the college basketball season, it's been bumpy, but we'll get there. The NBA season, they probably started too quick, but they had to. $500 million at stake, and you got to get the playoffs in before everybody leaves for the summer, because this year when you can travel, I mean, ask yourself, are you going to travel? Of course you are. But there's so much talent in college, so much talent in the pros, so many good stories to share with you. I hope you enjoyed this pod and give to the organization. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening and downloading this podcast throughout the year. Our numbers are unbelievable. Your support, remember to subscribe, rate, review, write a little review. I don't know. I think that helps me, I guess. I don't know. It couldn't hurt. Even if it's a negative review, but why would it be a negative review? You listen all the way to the end, right? I mean, that makes sense. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.